We are off and rolling on a Tuesday, April 29, 2025 is the date. Welcome into the Gabe Kuhn Show. I am your host, former Memphis Tiger Gabe Kuhn on X at G_Kuhn71. I'm alongside executive producer of the show. That would be Connor Dunning on X at CDunning99. Connor, how's it going, brother?
What's up, man?
Nothing much. I saw last night in the NBA playoffs, we had a little bit of positivity. I kind of want to, you know, deflect to the Grizzlies considering the way they went out against the Oklahoma City Thunder. Then I also, at the same time with that second game, don't know if you felt this way, if you got to watch the whole thing. My personal Hades hit. And I think most Grizzlies fans, most Memphis basketball fans, personal Hades hit with the Warriors getting over top of the Rockets. But we'll get to that in just a moment. We have 3 hours of talk all the way courtesy of 92.9 FM ESPN. And yours truly will open their NBA playoffs. We have a Dane Danger waiver that's been submitted. We'll cross our fingers. We'll talk about the way the roster's coming together. We'll have more NFL draft reaction. As far as guests are concerned, Jeff Calkins at 5 o'clock. From the Daily Memphian and the Jeff Calkins Show. And then 6 o'clock, we'll bring on Christian Fowler from Bluff City Media. I have the sneaking suspicion, just knowing me and Christian, we're going to talk a lot of NFL draft at 6 o'clock. Hop into the Blitz at 6:30. Get into have you been paying attention to the Bill Belichick, Jordan Hudson stuff?
Unfortunately.
74-year-old dating a 24-year-old.
Can't really avoid it.
CBS mornings over the weekend. TMZ report saying that North Carolina, which, of course, Bill Belichick is the head coach of, North Carolina higher-ups are kind of worried about Jordan Hudson's role in this whole Bill Belichick saga at this point in his career. But that'll be a fun thing, or maybe not so fun to talk about, but we will discuss it as we get into the Blitz. And also, I do want to revisit Grizzlies' exit interviews and what Ja Morant said about figuring out Oklahoma City Thunder, fair, foul, or otherwise. Also, did you see Ja Morant's tweet yesterday or last night?
I did.
Be careful what you wish for. Anything to write home about? Do we have any idea what he's talking about? I know that's what we do nowadays in sports media and sports talk radio. We try to break down social media.
I mean, he's probably heard the chatter about trade stuff from various media members and maybe some select few fans, but I think mass majority of the fan base and mass majority of the media here probably don't think it's a good idea to trade Ja Morant.
So. Yeah, I think that's fair. Now, I want to start with a little positivity, trying to deflect from the Grizzlies getting swept by the Thunder. It was a true hold my beer moment last night as the Cavs and the Heat met in the Kaseya Center for Game 4. Of course, the Heat lost. They got swept by the Cavs. But the hold my beer moment came is because the Grizzlies lost by 51 in Game 1 against the Thunder. It was the worst deficit, worst margin of victory in the NBA playoffs. The Heat made sure that didn't hold for very long. They lost by 50 freaking 5 last night. By 55! In a winner-go-home game, 138-83, at least the Grizzlies in Games 3 and Game 4 at home lost by 6 and lost by 2. Combined 8 points was the difference in the Grizzlies, you know, and their sort of win-or-go-home situation. Like, I feel better, not great, feel better about what the Grizzlies were able to do as far as a effort was concerned compared to the 1-8 matchup in the Eastern Conference. And, get this, Cleveland won the series by a combined 122 points over the Miami Heat. That now is the record for largest series point differential or margin. That is the full-on record in the NBA playoffs. They lost by a combined 122 points. They didn't give the Cavs very much. They had nothing for the Cavs. And last night, Tyler Hero, 4 points, 1-for-10 from the field.
They quit.
Yeah.
The Heat quit. And I'm going to be honest. I understand why the play-in is around. You're trying to have more intrigue at the end of the season. But last night and this entire series has shown why the play-in overall probably doesn't work.
Why
because
the Heat,
a team that's 37-45 should not be in the playoffs.
They should not be playing a team who won 60-plus games.
Right.
It's
as simple as that.
Yes.
There is the biggest gap you could possibly have between these. It's the Grand Canyon between the Cavaliers and the Miami Heat. They quit last night. It was an embarrassing performance. I'm really going to be interested to see what happens with the Heat this offseason because if they're not sellers, I don't know what the hell they're doing.
I don't know what they're going to do. Bam Adebayo after the game said, something is going to change. If you know anything about that silver-haired guy, that runs the organization, talking about Pat Riley, he said something's going to change. You can't have a situation unfold like they did against the Cavs, like you had against the Cavs, and not do anything because they're so far off. But at the same time, I don't know where they go with this. I don't like being competitive in the Eastern Conference with where they are right now, Tyler Hero being their pseudo best scorer. Then you have Bam Adebayo as their best overall player. You just have nothing around them. You've tried to rely on Heat culture too much. A bunch of guys that have moved on. You have Max Strus elsewhere. You have all these different guys around. Gabe Vincent that helped you get to Jimmy Butler's, obviously, with the Warriors. More on that in a second. You just don't have a team that is capable of being overly competitive in a playoff situation.
You have nothing to build around. You don't have a centerpiece at all. You have a bunch of guys that need to be probably the third guy on a team, if not the fourth guy on a team. They just don't have any foundation. And, you know, if I were the Heat, I would start by firing Eric Spoelstra so that he would be available for a team that may or may not be in Memphis to hire. That, you know, that's just, if I was Pat Riley, the number one thing I would do this offseason is definitely look at Eric Spoelstra and say, listen, you might be one of the best coaches in the NBA, maybe the best coach. We don't need your services anymore. Go to Memphis. I'm just saying.
In all seriousness. That would be fun. That would be great for the Grizzlies if that happened and the Grizzlies were able to make that hire. What needs to happen ultimately, and I've heard a bunch of, this is not just me saying this. Other people have had this thought. Pat Riley, I don't know if he's going to step away on his own accord, but somebody, maybe the ownership group, needs to say, Pat, you step back. Let's move Eric into your role and hire another coach. Because I think that's the natural progression of things with the way the Miami Heat have operated in the better part of the 21st century. So, like, that just makes sense. Some things make sense. That makes sense to me.
It's time, I think, for Pat Riley to step away. It's time. You've done a lot of great work in the NBA during your career, but the Miami Heat need a regime change. They need a roster change. They need a culture change, weirdly enough, down there. And I just don't think he needs to be at the helm anymore. The NBA has evolved, and I think that they need new eyeballs on this roster.
All right, now getting to people of Memphis, Memphis Grizzlies fans, and maybe my and your personal Hades last night. Watching the Warriors win that game was very frustrating. Rockets, I think for them, they need a better primary scoring and creating option than Jalen Green. He has been relatively miserable, besides the 38-point performance he had in Game 2. He just has been nothing. He had 8 points, 3 rebounds, 1 assist last night. Alperen Şengün has to do everything, but as a big in his position, trying to do everything for that team, when you're trading 2-for-3 with Steph Curry and Jimmy Butler and all those guys on the Warriors side, it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You need somebody to step up and be your primary creator on the wing. Now, Fred VanVleet had 25 last night. He was okay. But Jalen Green, if you get a performance like that where you're shooting 20% from three, you have 8 points, you're not going to win a game. You're just not. Now, they ended up losing 109-106. What makes it so much more frustrating for me is, you know, we have respect on the Gabe Kuhn Show for Draymond Green and what he's been able to do in his National Basketball Association career. We have respect for it. Future Hall of Famer, great defender, Defensive Player of the Year, championship winner. I have great respect for his accomplishments and his accolades. But as a player and the way he conducts himself at this point in his career, it's just we're relatively anti-Draymond Green in the antics.
Correct.
I think most people are. I hate the fact that I'm watching that game and it feels like the Draymond Green leeway that he gets with the referees was the reason that the Warriors were able to go in.
It's insane.
If you didn't watch, he got a technical early in the game. And you can say that it was kind of phantom, what have you. But I think, you know, Draymond Green and his reputation should follow him. If he gets a technical foul for getting into some type of spat, it is what it is. But there was a scrap with Steph Curry and Dylan Brooks that Draymond Green got involved with. They threw a technical on him. I believe it was early in the second quarter. But as we get later in the game, Draymond Green kept his legs in a spat he got into with Tari Eason. He kept his legs on top of Tari Eason when they both went to the ground. Now, Eason pushed back at Draymond because he was doing it on purpose. Draymond does the same. But because of the technical foul that the referees gave to Draymond earlier in the game, they called that spat a flagrant foul so Draymond Green wouldn't be ejected. I have no other way of viewing that, Connor. Did you view that any other way?
No.
They kept it as a flagrant one so he would not be thrown out of the game. And I know we have a history with this. Like 2016, a lot of people think it doesn't happen without Draymond Green, you know, the 3-1 comeback, all that. With LeBron James, doesn't happen with Draymond Green out of the game. And we've had some notable omissions and suspensions in the playoffs that have hurt the Warriors. But if you're calling a technical foul and there's a scrap and there's a pushing and shoving, that's not a flagrant. A flagrant is usually in the court. You know, hard foul, closing out recklessly, that type of thing. This was not a closeout. This was not a normal foul. He kept his legs on top of Tari Eason and created a distraction and a shoving match on the floor. That's a technical foul. But I just think that was an egregious example of him officiating, being officiated differently. He consistently gets passes with referee official after official after official, and it just gets frustrating. And of course, because he's able to stay in the game with that flagrant one on top of the technical, he gets the game-winning stop on Alperen Şengün and ultimately on Fred VanVleet. Because he was in the game, ultimately the Warriors were able to play enough good defense down the stretch for them to get over top 109-106 and get this series to 3-1 and have the chance to win it. It's really hard to come back from 3-1. Does not happen very often.
It has happened against the Warriors before, though.
Has happened against the Warriors before, but this
I don't think the Rockets have LeBron James.
LeBron James isn't on the other side.
Correct.
But then after the game, I have to hear Jimmy Butler, who really has given that team new life. And I want to give respect to Jimmy Butler. He was great last night.
He's
put them over the top into, okay, they can compete in the Western Conference. He dropped 27, by the way, last night. But then I have to hear him say he's got his joy back, the joy that he lost when he was in Miami. It was just, as a guy who covers the Grizzlies, considers myself a fan of the Grizzlies, is in the city of Memphis and has dealt with the Warriors on multiple occasions and seen this happen time and time again, that was my personal hell. It was really hard and really tough to watch the way that game ended down the stretch.
Last night's game is why I thought the Warriors were going to win this series, because one, I just didn't think the Rockets had enough consistency from a guy like Jalen Green to be able to get it done. And we saw that he had a really good game this series, but he has been pretty up and down. And last night, he just didn't have it. 8 points is not going to get it done in that type of game. When you are relying on Alperen Şengün to be your number one offensive weapon, and you're going up against a team like the Warriors, it can be hard to keep up because you're trading twos for threes with the Warriors, which ultimately, just math, is not going to lead to you winning many basketball games. Fred VanVleet made the three-point shooting look a lot better last night because he went 8 from 12, but the rest of their team couldn't hit water if they fell out of a boat. It was awful last night. It was awful outside of Fred VanVleet, their shooting. So they just could not keep up with the Golden State Warriors. The Warriors' experience and their defense at the end of the day were able to get it done. I thought Dylan Brooks had a really good game. I think the Warriors also, or not the Warriors, the Rockets, they've got to make Thompson more. They got to give him more runway on the offensive end, I think, sometimes. Because at the end of that game, he put his head down a couple of times and said, I'm going to go get a bucket and make sure that we're still in this game when we have a chance to win. And that's what he did. And then they just kind of stopped going to him. And they let Jalen Green take over in a few moments. Fred VanVleet kept firing it away. And they just kept throwing the ball down to Alperen Şengün. And it just, they became stale. They became stagnant after a while. And to be honest, it was also really interesting that all season we've been hearing Grizzlies fans clamoring for the days of Steven Adams, clamoring for the days of Dylan Brooks, wishing that Ime was the head coach. And listen, I'm a big fan of Ime Udoka. He was bad last night. He got outcoached by Steve Kerr. He made a couple bad calls down the stretch. But all of that, and they've won a single more game than the Grizzlies did this playoffs. Yep. And it's just like, that goes to show that it is so hard to win in today's NBA, and the Grizzlies aren't just a Dylan Brooks or Steven Adams away from being in contention. There's a lot of things that have to go right for a team. And I just think with the Warriors, they don't have that number one guy.
Right.
When you look at their roster and you say, who's your number one guy? Some nights it's going to be Şengün. Some nights it's going to be Jalen Green. Some nights it's going to be Fred VanVleet. Some nights it might be Amen Thompson. But they need a number one guy. And that's why this offseason, I'm really interested to see what they do because there's going to be a couple of names out there on the market. They've got a lot of assets, a lot of really good young basketball players that you can flip for like Giannis or Kevin Durant, cost-controlled contracts. They are going to be interested. They're going to be an interesting team to keep your eye on. I still think that they might be able to win a game or two here. They're still going to make it interesting because they are still talented. I hope that they do because this series has been really fun to watch. But last night, the Warriors shooting, their veteran play, and their defense down the stretch got it done. There's no doubt about it. Draymond being able to stay in the game
was
shouldn't have
huge
happened.
Difference too.
But it's at some point, he's just called like this his whole career. I don't understand why. I disagree with it. It pisses me off. But this is just how it goes with Draymond Green. And it is why it is so frustrating when they come out and they talk about code breaking. They talk about dirty plays and all this stuff because we watch the game and we have eyeballs and we see that Draymond gets to run around like a jackass and he gets away with it. And it's very, very frustrating.
I've had some issues with officiating outside of that game as well. We had the pool report from the Lakers-Timberwolves game 4. As well, where Luka Doncic did get tripped by Jaden McDaniels.
And what was that angle from space?
They say after the fact that it should have been a foul and probably would have changed the game. I think it happened at 35 seconds. We had, obviously, the pool report from the Knicks and the Pistons game where Tim Hardaway Jr. was very clearly fouled by Josh Hart on a three-pointer to end that game, and it took the Pistons' chance to win away. So I've had some issues with this officiating, just generally speaking, in the first round of the NBA playoffs.
I think it's been better than the regular season, but we've talked about it the officiating's been bad this year.
But there's been swing calls that have affected outcomes late in games, or with the Draymond Green thing, just you keep him in a game so he can make really clutch plays down the stretch of the game.
Well, there's a balance between allowing more physicality in the playoffs, which we all want to see, and they have been doing. But in late-game situations, if there is a foul, you need to call it. You need to call it. Because on all those examples that you just said, they were clearly fouls. You have to call that because it changes the games.
Why? And also, this has been one of my biggest pet peeves about the NBA for a while, really since Adam Silver took over. I mean, pool reports.
What's
the point?
There's no point.
What's the point?
It's just to piss us off.
It doesn't change the outcome. You can't go back and replay it. Whoever won, won. Whoever lost, lost. But you're telling us you made a mistake that ultimately changed the outcome of that game and changed the winner and loser. But, like, it does nothing.
I would rather not have them.
Exactly. It's so frustrating. It's just I'd rather it just not be there. I'd rather it not happen.
I've never looked at a pool report and said, you know what? They got that wrong, but at least they're honest about it. That's never once made me feel better after a loss when a big call was blown. Never
now,
once.
Here's my big question after watching the Warriors take a 3-1 series lead. When you look at the lead they have, who they ultimately could play going forward, whether it be Lakers or Timberwolves, I mean, what do you think about their chances to potentially get to a Western Conference Finals, potentially compete to get into the NBA Finals against a young team like the Oklahoma City Thunder? Because I look around the Western Conference, obviously the Clippers and the Nuggets still around, really good teams. They're playing a knockdown, dragout series, though, so maybe they'll be tired and there could be some injuries. We know the Nuggets have slowed down to a certain extent. Kawhi Leonard, so who knows if something catches up to him relatively soon. Like, last night did show me, in the end of the day, the Warriors still have as good a shot as anybody to compete to get into the Western Conference Finals, have a chance to go get to an NBA Finals.
As long as they have Jimmy and Steph healthy, they're going to be a very difficult team to beat. Jimmy Butler is a playoff performer, and he has shown it. The one game that they didn't have them, they looked extremely vulnerable. They did not look like the Golden State Warriors. Steph has also been very good so far in the playoffs. And nobody's really talking about him last night, but Podziemski had one of the best playoff games of his career, if not the best playoff game of his career. I think that the Timberwolves would probably give them more of a difficult time than the Lakers, but we also expect that it's going to be the Timberwolves. I am going to become the biggest Timberwolves fan on the planet the next round if they make it through and they have to play the Golden State Warriors.
Well, and it is kind of funny. Like, the Warriors and my thoughts on them have a lot to do with our pre-playoff thought of, are the Lakers going to be able to be that team?
The Warriors
have replaced the Lakers in my mind in regards to that veteran-laden team that can actually make a run.
The one thing that I do think that the Timberwolves have, that the Rockets don't. They have a bona fide number one.
Yep.
And Anthony Edwards, who is going to show up pretty much every playoff game. He has shown that he can do it in the playoffs in big moments. They have a ton of size, too. A lot of size. Naz Reid, yeah. Rudy Gobert, Julius Randle. That's going to be an issue. They have very good perimeter defenders. That's the one weakness about the Warriors. Their center position is where they can be vulnerable. And if the Timberwolves can take advantage of that,
sure,
they may be able to do something. Like, Naz Reid is the type of guy that could throw a wrench in the Warriors' plans. So it's going to be a fascinating matchup.
And in this conversation,
I also think it matters that Ant plays defense.
This conversation that we're having is very similar about similar to the conversation we were having about the Timberwolves versus the Lakers going into this series.
Yeah,
and I watched, very much so. And it's kind of funny. And I know it was on Sunday night, but J.J. Redick played the same five the whole second half. It was Reeves, Luka, Dorian Finney-Smith, LeBron, and Rui. Bron didn't have a single point in the fourth quarter.
Yikes.
But you know what's interesting? I feel like everyone out there is talking about that storyline the wrong way. What I mean by that is everybody's talking about it in the way that you leave the same five for a whole half because you want to, right? I don't think J.J. Redick left that same five on the court the whole half because he wanted to. I think you do that because you have to.
You had to. He didn't have no choice.
The Lakers, one thing we didn't really grasp that I did, I tried to get ahead of this. One thing that a lot of people didn't grasp, because people like talking about LA, the market, and the Lakers, really historically good franchise, the Lakers don't have a good enough team. People didn't want to talk about that. And that's why I picked the Timberwolves. Jackson Hayes has been non-existent this series in a matchup where you have a bunch of bigs on the other side. So you look at the Lakers and what J.J. Redick did in that second half, they have to play small. And then what happens if you play small against the Timberwolves? Naz Reid drops 23. Julius Randle averages over 20 a game. And then I don't think people pay attention to, you know, outside of just their bigs, their big in general.
Jaden McDaniels.
By the way, Jaden McDaniels, 6'9".
He's been awesome.
What the hell are the Lakers going to do with that? What are the Warriors going to do with that if they get that matchup?
Right.
And you wonder why a guy like Jaden McDaniels at 6'9", drops 30 in game three, only made one three-pointer that night. Like, who's that assignment for the Lakers? Who's that assignment for the Warriors? For the Lakers, it was like Austin Reeves. Like, who do you throw on Jaden McDaniels?
I mean, the Timberwolves eight deep. Is Randle, McDaniels, Gobert, Conley, Edwards, Reed, DiVincenzo, Nikhil Alexander-Walker. It's a damn good eight. It's a gritty eight. It's a big eight. A lot of shooting. A lot of defense. A lot of smart basketball.
You know the other truth we didn't tell, generally, as a sports talk society, that we didn't tell ourselves? The Lakers are a flawed team with two generational superstars. And we've been having the conversation for, I don't know, the past 5 years since we've had different champions every year. Aren't those teams out of favor? Like, you look at the top four teams in the NBA this year, Celtics. They've done it with Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum, but look at the guys surrounding them. Derek White can drop 30 any given game. Kristaps Porzingis can space
Peyton
the floor.
Pritchard.
Peyton Pritchard is sixth man of the year. Drew Holiday, really damn good point guard. So it's like a full team. The Thunder. You know, as much as we want to talk about SGA and Jalen Williams, the rest of their roster is phenomenal. Lou Dort, one of the best defenders in the entire league. Chet Holmgren can stretch out to the three-point line. Isaiah Hartenstein has brought like a different level of physicality. Aaron Wiggins off the bench, like all these different guys. The Cavs, Ty Jerome was there for sixth man of the year. 1 through 5, they're phenomenal. The Knicks, 1 through 5, phenomenal. I don't think they have as much depth as the other teams. That's why they were 0-for against the top teams in the NBA. But you're getting my point. The thought about the Lakers being with Luka Doncic and LeBron James, a team that could potentially push for an NBA Finals, I always thought was a bit of a farce. Just because those types of teams that are as top-heavy as they are and don't have as much depth as the best teams in the NBA, those teams are out of favor. Those teams don't win at the same rate that they used to.
Or you have to have three guys that you can rely on every night. And the thing with the Lakers in this series so far is all three of them haven't had really a good game at the same time yet. It's either been LeBron and Luka or LeBron. It's really just been LeBron and Luka. Like, Austin Reeves has not been great throughout the playoffs so far. Luka's defense has been a problem. LeBron going 0-for in the fourth quarter wasn't great because they had a 10-point lead going into that fourth quarter, and then they got outscored 32-19. It's just rough. And Julius Randle has been great for the Minnesota Timberwolves. Like you said, though, we said before this series, go look at Rudy Gobert's minutes, and that's going to tell you who's going to win the series. If Rudy Gobert can stay on the basketball court, the Minnesota Timberwolves are probably going to win the series. And guess what he's been able to do? Stay on the court.
All right. Now, final thing. Before we grab our first break of the day, talk Dane Danger and his waiver and the Tigers and their roster that they're putting together. Did you watch ESPN today talking about Giannis and the Bucks? Their body's not even cold.
I mean, the
game will be played in 30 minutes. Bucks versus Pacers, game five. Pacers are at home, have a chance to close it out. I fully expect them to close it out. Dame Lillard's tore his Achilles. Just brutal for him. He had the deep vein thrombosis.
That's awful.
Comes
yeah,
back.
That's terrible. His Achilles, I hate that.
I don't know if he's ever going to be the same player. Like, that was really, really hard to watch.
Very hard.
But in all likelihood, the Pacers are going to close out the Bucks. But they have a chance to extend the series. And you have Carlos Boozer and the ESPN crew before the Bucks' body is even cold talking about Giannis to the Lakers. And I fully grasp on to the idea that Giannis could be on the move. Giannis could be on the move this offseason. He wants to go win somewhere, right, wherever that may be. I don't think the Lakers make much sense in the slightest.
What are the Lakers
going to
give?
What are they going to give? They have one first-round pick in 2031 that they can give up in a trade for that? One first-round pick.
Are you giving up Reeves?
You could give up a bunch of player assets, all the player assets you want. If the Bucks are getting rid of Giannis Antetokounmpo and letting him walk, they're going to need probably three-plus unprotected first-round picks to actually make sense of letting Giannis walk to another team.
Yeah.
And the Lakers can't facilitate that. They don't have enough in the way of draft assets.
Like, yeah, if the Lakers could get Giannis, that'd be a good spot for him playing next to LeBron and Luka. I just don't know I don't think they have enough to get him. What are they going to offer the Bucks? Or they're like, yeah, like Austin Reeves?
I mean, no, Reeves, like DFS, Reeves, Dalton Connect, guys like that.
I would say, you can get, I'm not saying that you're saying it's good enough. You can get way better for Giannis.
Even if you
like the Rockets.
Even those three guys we're talking about, right, that I just brought up, Dalton Connect, Austin Reeves, DFS, you're going to need multiple unprotected first-round picks to be able to throw that at the Bucks to even make that a reasonable trade.
There are a few teams that I think could get Giannis. I think the Rockets are one of them. It sounds like the Nets are going to try to go after him. They do have the assets. I just don't think it makes any sense.
Theoretically, I'm going to throw this out there, even though it's not going to happen. Theoretically, the Grizzlies have
I was going to say the Grizzlies. The Grizzlies
absolutely
have enough. They absolutely have enough. There just have to be some hard conversations. But, yeah, they have enough.
Yeah.
Would the Bucks say yes? That's the question.
You'd probably have to move off Jaren.
They got enough.
And or Desmond Bane.
The Suns are an interesting one to keep an eye on because of Durant.
Yeah.
Suns are an interesting one. There are teams that could potentially get it done.
The Nuggets probably have them.
The Lakers are not one of them. Detroit's one of them. Orlando's one of them. There are a lot of teams that could, but I just don't think that it's the Lakers. And that's where the stupid Luka trade, it is now.
Yes, it's warped everyone's mind.
It's that the Lakers delusion of we can get anybody. It got proven right when they traded for Luka for nothing. I guess not nothing, but Anthony Davis. But like essentially nothing when it comes to the price of what Luka Doncic should have been. So it has caused this delusion, and it has poisoned the minds of, I think, a lot of NBA meetings where it's like, yeah, maybe the Lakers will get him. Who knows? But who knows? Maybe the Bucks will take Austin Reeves and Dalton Connect and a penny. Who knows? I just don't understand how they do it. But no, it makes no sense for the Bucks to trade Giannis to the Lakers. It makes no sense.
I'm with you. Now, when we're talking about building rosters in the NBA, other teams are going to be looking for Giannis, but we need to talk about the roster that's being built here in Memphis for Memphis basketball. Penny Hardaway has been hard at work on the transfer portal, and today we got news that Dane Danger has officially submitted his waiver to the NCAA. We'll go through his case and what we think, what's our confidence level about him returning for another year at Memphis. We'll do all that next. So we have some Memphis basketball news today. Penny Hardaway, Dane Danger, everybody has gotten together, and the waiver request for an additional season of eligibility has been submitted for Dane Danger to the NCAA by the U of M Athletics Compliance Office. There has been some questions about, you know, how long will this take? I don't know what the time frame looks like. Could be weeks, could be days, could be months. Who knows? For reference, we talked a couple of years ago about DeAndre Williams and if he could get another year. He went through the waiver process. He submitted on July 10th, 2023, so we're ahead of that date. But the Tigers did not get a final answer from the NCAA until November 3rd into the season of that season. So, you know, and obviously it was a no. Ultimately, it was a denial of that waiver request. So we're sort of going to be waiting this entire offseason, as we have on multiple occasions, to see if a player for Penny Hardaway's team can get an extra year. Now, the case itself, to me, just looking at it face value, it seems to make sense. It really does. Dane Danger, at this point, has played at Baylor, Illinois, and Memphis. 2 years at Illinois, basically 3 games for 3 minutes at a time at Baylor, and then, of course, last year at Memphis, where he averaged 14 points per game and nearly 8 rebounds. The first year at Baylor is the real point of contention. He played in 3 games, didn't get much run, ultimately at the end of that year transferred out. Now, some people could look at that and say immediately he should get that year back. Now, what the NCAA's argument would be in regards to Dane Danger not getting that year back is he had some academic ineligibility, not unlike what happened with DeAndre Williams in his time when he was with Evansville. So the NCAA could ultimately say, yeah, you know what, we'll give you some leeway for that, and they could approve. But I think historically at the University of Memphis, when it comes to academic ineligibility, if you use the DeAndre Williams example as a sort of starting point, that has been denied before for Penny Hardaway and his team. If Dane Danger was hurt that year, and that's why he played in 3 games, if he ended up redshirting, he would have another year of eligibility. But because he was academically ineligible, that's why that year is lost for him. Now, I do want to point out why his case should not be as hard as it seems right this second. Because I look at a couple of players. One played last year. One's going to played last year for Auburn and then is going to play this year for USC. Let's start with Chad Baker Mazzara. Chad Baker Mazzara, he's going to go on 26 years old when he's playing for USC. He just committed relatively recently. He's played for Duquesne, San Diego State, and, of course, Auburn. Every single year of his 4 years of eligibility were no red shirt, didn't have a medical hardship, didn't have anything like that. He played 15 games at Duquesne. He played 31 games at San Diego State, 35 games at Auburn, 38 games at Auburn last season. So he completely use the eligibility meter. You can only participate in about 3 games if you want to maintain eligibility and get that year back. He did not pass through any of that, but I believe because of the COVID year and everything else, he's going to get that Duquesne year back because that was the 2020-2021 season because he's been playing for so long. But I also want to point out a guy who ended up playing for Texas last year. We know his name because he played at Houston relatively recently. Let's go to Tremont Mark. Tremont Mark played 5 years, 5 years of college basketball. 1 year was a medical hardship year that he ultimately got back, but he's had 4 years of real eligibility where he played 32 games, 37 games, 31 games, and 29 games. So, like, when I just look at the amount of games versus Dane Danger and what he put out there year one at Baylor with only 3, and he only averaged 3 minutes per game when he got into those 3 games, didn't start a single one, it feels like the case should not be as hard as it has been in the past. Now, the NCAA is going to make their ultimate decision however they see fit, but when you compare it to other examples around the country, it just feels like Dane Danger should have a better shot than it seems like he has at this particular moment. Only had 3 games that year one at Baylor, and then participated 3 full years, whether it be at Illinois or Memphis. Now, again, the one big point of contention the NCAA can hold over his head is that at Baylor, those 3 games that he spent on that roster, it was not, COVID. It wasn't medical. It wasn't anything like that. What it ultimately came down to, he only participated in 3 games because it was academic ineligibility. The NCAA is usually relatively tough on those things. So it's going to be interesting to see if he gets this year back. But when you compare Dane Danger's situation to other players that have asked for extra years and ultimately got them, it feels like Dane Danger should have a decent shot.
It feels like he should have a decent shot. It's just, the NCAA, unfortunately, is not known for their consistency or their fairness when it comes to, you know, case-by-case basis. You just have no idea what they are going to decide, what they're going to determine is the biggest factor. All of those examples you brought up, I agree with. It's just, we know Memphis's relationship with the NCAA. Are they going to hold the past against Memphis? Waivers have not worked out for Memphis before, but I do think this is a different type of situation than even like the DeAndre Williams one, because of how much basketball DeAndre Williams actually had played. Like, Dane Danger's really only played three seasons, like full season. So I really hope he gets it, because if Dane Danger,
right,
is able to be a Memphis Tiger, I think you could argue this might be a top 25 preseason team.
Yes.
If he isn't a Memphis Tiger, then they're probably borderline and left outside of that top 25, and they have a little bit more prove it to do. But this team would give them a bona fide number one guy. He'd be the best player in the conference. They'd be without a doubt the best team in the conference. And it feel like the entire season would be leading up to an NCAA appearance with the roster they have right now. Dane Danger next to Aaron Bradshaw would do a lot of damage in the American.
Yes, when you look at the team as currently constructed, no Dane Danger, this is a team that's clearly the best in the AAC. There's some depth where I think they lacked a little bit last year. If one injury happened, we saw it with Tyrese Hunter against Colorado State, they really struggled. They got knocked out of the tournament early. So I think this team would still be, without Dane Danger, the best in the AAC, a team that would be an NCAA tournament team. And I would be curious to see how Joe Lunardi looked at it without Dane Danger. He may have them as an AQ. He had them as an AQ last year. But, you know, I think this team, even without Dane Danger, could potentially push for an at-large bid, considering how they schedule in the out-of-conference. And if they win those games, we know how that goes. But if you add Dane Danger to it, it completely changes the calculus for what this team could accomplish. Because right now, Aaron Bradshaw, as much as I like Aaron Bradshaw and believe in what he could become, former five-star, former McDonald's All-American, he has not really shown it. At a high level. He was not great at Kentucky, was not great at Ohio State, had some fouling issues. He's more of a finesse big man, where Dane Danger is really very much rough and tumble, back to the basket, go score at will at the rim. But if you had those two on the roster at the same time, the 1-2 punch, the high-low combinations, the ability Dane Danger would have to potentially kick it out to a guy like Aaron Bradshaw or Doug McDaniel or Sincere Parker out there on the wing, to knock down some threes, I just feel like it's another dimension that would make this team so much more dangerous, and way more dangerous by the time you get into the NCAA tournament. Because without him, they have not recruited the type of big or the amount of bigs to be very good in the front court. But if you add Dane Danger, you take that front court to a new level that a lot of teams in the country will not have at their disposal.
Speaking of NCAA tournament, I just looked it up. Joe Lunardi has sent out his 2026
bracketology. Yes.
Where, I will tell you, Memphis is an automatic qualifier. They are in the NCAA tournament.
As a 9 seed.
No.
8 seed.
No.
10 seed.
No.
11?
11.
Ooh.
Playing Alabama.
Oh, that would is a 6 seed.
Who is a 6 seed.
That's okay. You don't think Alabama's going to be ranked higher?
I know. It's
who
a
are
bit
the one? Can you take me through the one seeds that he has for his first bracketology?
Yeah, the one seeds are Purdue, Houston, St. John's, and Duke.
Okay. St. John's, Houston, I can get behind. Duke just won the Natty. Not just won the Natty, but it's coming off a year where they were very, very good, and they're going to replenish. They have three more freshmen coming in. They could attack the transfer portal relatively well. I would say that, I don't know, I find that a bit interesting. Duke replenishing without Cooper Flagg and immediately putting them as a one seed? I know that Duke's historically good. That's
11 seed.
That's an 11 seed for the University of Memphis. If they get Dane Danger back, certainly he'd have to change that.
100%.
Seed
this
block.
Has to. How
far does that shoot them up in that bracketology?
Oh, this was updated yesterday.
Yes, no, it's brand new.
Yeah, it's brand new. So I was wondering, like, was this before some of the latest recruits from Memphis or latest transfers from Memphis? But now it's up to date. But yeah, Dane Danger, like, I would think that Memphis could potentially be a 5 seed.
Where does he put the national championship winner, Florida? Do you have that in front of you?
I got to find
him. You have to scroll a little bit.
Seed.
Okay. So he still has them relatively high. Okay. 11 seed.
BYU's a number 2.
That's fair.
UConn's a number two. Michigan's a number two, and Kentucky's a number two. That makes sense. Those make sense.
Memphis is an 11 seed.
Feels low.
Automatic qualifier.
Feels low. But he's always lowballed Memphis.
Well, I would, with Memphis and a completely replenished roster.
This also doesn't matter. It's just interesting
but
to
also,
see.
Like, again, when we get down to it, Connor, we've had this conversation. We've been burned by this conversation before. Continuity does matter when you're trying to place teams in an NCAA tournament in freaking April. You know what I mean?
I want to ask you.
You have to be able to know what that roster is going to be top to bottom before you really give Memphis a whole bunch of credit for what they have.
Yeah, and this matters for not. This doesn't matter at all.
Of course not.
It just doesn't matter. But I do want to ask you this. Do you think the Dane Danger waiver is more important than the DeAndre Williams one would have been?
That's tough to say. I mean, do you have a take on that? I would say yes, just because of the season they're coming off of,
yeah,
and the trajectory that you want to see continue to happen.
Now,
the trajectory you want to see this team take.
It is very difficult to not have hindsight in this conversation, but we know what that team ended up being. I don't know if DeAndre Williams would have been able to fix that team or save that team. I do think that they would have been better. But that team was broken.
Okay, fair. But what was the big point of contention that threw them off completely? Do you remember?
Their leader getting hurt.
Caleb Mills getting hurt.
Sure.
If you had another player leader, a guy who brought energy every single night, we talk about it all the time with team after team, whether it be football, basketball, whatever. There's a bit of emotional follow the leader.
Yes.
And once they lost Caleb Mills, they didn't have that emotional leader they could follow. DeAndre Williams, had you gotten him on that team, you'd be able to follow that emotion, that energy, and I think he would have lifted up the rest of the roster. Now, that's an abstract thought, a little more abstract than normal, but I do think he would have helped dramatically.
I think he would have helped in the leadership department for sure. The reason I'm not sure if it would have changed a ton, though, is he isn't a perimeter defender. And that's when Caleb Mills went down, they really lost all of their perimeter defense. And that crushed them by the end of the season. I do think that team would have been better with DeAndre Williams. They probably wouldn't have fallen apart the same way that they did. It is impossible to not use hindsight when talking about that team. I just think that this one specifically, with what we know the American is going to be next season, with what we know the roster is right now, if you just plug in Dane Danger to this team as is, it's damn near impossible for this team to not make the NCAA tournament.
Okay, if I'm trying to do what DeAndre Williams would have meant to that
team. We could also see maybe it's equal. Maybe they are of equal importance.
Versus what Dane Danger would mean to this particular roster. I think DeAndre Williams, considering all that happened, with the ability to have the hindsight on Caleb Mills' injury and everything else, I think DeAndre Williams would have willed that team to some type of tournament appearance.
I agree with that.
I don't know if they would have had a bunch of upside without Caleb Mills and all that, and the way that the team was built with Javon Quinterly as the main on-ball guy. You know, he was turning the ball over. His head wasn't really in it. It was hard to get him involved and get him going game to game. Very inconsistent. So I think DeAndre Williams would have made that team from a leadership standpoint. You'd have kept the leadership, kept the energy, probably into the tournament,
mm-hmm,
based on what they did in the out-of-conference. Get a couple more wins in conference, make the tournament. I think Dane Danger, I personally look at this roster that they have and look at the AAC and everything that's been lost in the AAC.
Right.
UAB has nothing.
Right.
Tulane is really the team you're looking at is, okay, they still have Rowan Brumbaugh, they still have some guys. I think this team, as constructed right now, is likely a tournament team.
Right.
Likely a tournament team. You had Dane Danger to the fold, 15 points per game, 8 rebounds per game, a down-low presence to add to all the perimeter scoring that they have in Sincere Parker and Doug McDaniel and guys like that, Julius Thedford. I think it takes them from tournament team to potentially second weekend team,
right,
if you get Dane Danger. So it's about upside. I don't know if the DeAndre Williams addition would have had the same upside as Dane Danger's, if that makes sense.
Right. My instinct would say they're probably of equal importance. I just think that this team would have the ability to go further, given the circumstances.
Yes. That's exactly what I'm saying. It's about the upside of adding these guys. upside for DeAndre Williams to me, looking at how that team was constructed, NCAA tournament appearance, you hope and pray for something after that.
Now, we could
also say, the expectation becomes, to this team, the expectation becomes you better win a game in the tournament. Yeah. You better try to make as deep a run as you can.
I also, though, there could be a perspective here where if we are saying that we believe that this team as constructed, because of what the American is, should be able to make the NCAA tournament with or without Dane Danger, but that team couldn't have made it unless they had DeAndre Williams. Maybe that means DeAndre Williams was the more important.
Well, maybe.
There's that perspective, too. Yes. So I think it's an interesting conversation to have because it is a similar situation where there is a team constructed that you believe should have a chance to make the NCAA tournament. But if you plugged one of these bigs in, they would absolutely be an NCAA tournament.
And I think expectations have changed from the fan base after watching that team win 29 games.
Right.
Right? Like, they want them to make the tournament, but that's baseline. That's like, get in the damn tournament.
I do think there was more desperation.
I think fans, after watching that early bounce for Colorado State, I think just that expectation of win a damn game, try to make a run is so much more apparent than it was even at that time. Even at that time. And I know like the expectations were so we had like a roller coaster of emotion that year because you come out of the out of conference schedule and they're what, 10-3 or whatever it was, or 11-2, whatever it was. They were top 10 team. They were the AP top 10 team. So everybody's thinking, okay, this team can make a deep run. Then they fall off a cliff. So the emotions
down,
were all over the place.
Changed.
I think we're at a more stable emotional spot than we were at that time.
I think there was more desperation with the DeAndre Williams one. I think I've gone back to the other side. I think that as we talk through it, I'm like, I think the DeAndre one was more important.
That's an interesting ask, though. That's an interesting question that you pose. I don't know if there's a right answer. In the eye of the beholder.
We also, it's difficult to do this, though, now, because we have the hindsight of that team. And we have no idea what this team really looks like. We know what they look like on paper. We don't know how they're going to play together. We don't know what any of that's going to look like. So it's going to be interesting to see.
I wonder if Jeff Calkins has some takes on this.
Maybe he does.
Maybe he does. So let's go ahead and get him on the show, on the other side right here on 92.9 FM ESPN.